NBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. It was Christmas Eve, 2002. Lacey Peterson was 8.5 months pregnant with a baby boy that she had already named Connor. The only information that we have about Lacey's movements on that morning come from her husband, Scott, the man that was later convicted of murdering her and their unborn son and sentenced to death. Scott tells police that he left the house around 9:30 a.m. and Lacey was alive and well, watching Martha Stewart on TV. 3.5 months later, Lacey and Connor's bodies were discovered by a couple out walking their dog in a marshy area of the San Francisco Bay Shore. This one is a mysterious case that could seem like it has an obvious solution at times, but from another perspective, some might say that there is no actual evidence indicating that Scott is the murderer. I'm going to tell you right now that you're not about to hear a whole lot of case details in this episode. We'll be getting into those details on Friday's follow-up. Today, I want to focus in on the most bizarre element of the case: the actions, decisions, and psychology of Scott Peterson, both pre-offense and post-offense. Joining me today to break down the psychology behind the murders of Lacey and Connor Peterson is one of the hosts of the LA Not So Confidential podcast, Dr. Scott. I learned a lot and was fascinated by the way Dr. Scott explains Peterson's actions, and I think that you will too. This is Season 9, Episode 10, The Case of the Murder of Lacey Peterson.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just Say You're Sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Dr. Scott, we just had a brief conversation off the air that I think the listeners may be interested in. So you are one of the hosts of LA Not So Confidential, and I had asked you if Scott was your first name or your last name, and it seems that already we have some things in common as to why you are Dr. Scott. So can you explain a little bit about that and a little bit about who you are and what you do now?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that setup. So Dr. Shiloh and I are the hosts of a true crime and forensic psychology podcast called LA Not So Confidential. We ostensibly called it that because, you know, we're both, I guess I've been here long enough to now be considered a native of Southern California, although I grew up in Alabama. And Shiloh has, you know, been here all her life. And we met doing our forensic psych internships together years ago and really hit it off immediately. And one of the things that happened, I mean, you know, it's fast forward a decade later, and Shiloh turns to me as we're walking back from lunch one day and she says, I think we should do a podcast. And I'm like, no, we're not going to do that. And then, of course, within about 30 steps, she'd convinced me. And but we realized very quickly, because we both work, Shiloh, I'm a former law enforcement psychologist. I'm a former correction psychologist, and Shiloh is a law enforcement psychologist. And we both work with large agencies. So in order to maintain the separation between those things, we go only by our first names. And we're very careful. Like, you know, we tend to focus on things that have, there's a little bit of distance. If we pick out crimes, we'll pick out things that are maybe happening right now, but it's easier to talk about them if they're in another state. You know, if there's something super current and it's happening in Southern California, we really have to be very careful about offering any kind of perspective, because we would not want to mess up the legal proceedings in any way. So, you know, we're a little coy about using our names, but like I was telling you, anybody that was a deep diver or even a medium diver with internet searches could figure out who we are.
Yeah, that this I went through this similar thing as with a stage name. When I started my podcast, I was actually a fire chief, and the first podcast I started was actually called Off Duty, which we don't do that one anymore. But I went by for 2-3 years on that show as Chief. No one knew my name because I was just Chief, because I didn't want my name out there, because working for or with government agencies, that it's real easy to get called in front of a board in my case and have to answer to why I'm speaking publicly about anything.
Right.
So I want to learn a little bit more about you. I've listened to quite a few of your guys' episodes. They're great, by the way. I love them.
And oh, thank you. Thank you.
I'm really into them. I'm like an amateur criminal behavior analyst. You know, I'm good friends with Jim Clementi, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh yeah.
And he's taught me a little bit, and I've got all the books, which gives me just enough knowledge to think I know what I'm doing when I really don't. But I'm fascinated by the field. So this is why I'm fascinated by your podcast. But you know, I started doing a little bit of research on you, speaking of deep divers and creepers. And so far, all I've really come up with is you much like Jim, you spent some time in the TV world, and also you've kicked a World of Warcraft addiction.
I tend to have maybe a bit of an addictive personality, and that was probably the closest I ever came to something that was impairing aspects of my life. But damn, it was fun. It was fun. It was some good times. But I was in entertainment. I was a performer all through high school and college on scholarship. And then I worked in Chicago and moved my way out to L.A. And after I kind of realized like it was time to transition out of performing, I was really lucky. I had a very good friend who was an agent at a very large agency. And he said, look, I don't know if you want to be an agent or not, but why don't you come work here as an assistant, and you will learn what you need to know, and you will have doors open to you. And I think, you know, he certainly saw something in me, which I really appreciated, because I had no idea what to do after coming out of performance for a decade. And I had a great experience at this very large, like multinational talent agency. And I figured out very quickly that as much as I liked different aspects of it, that was not something that I wanted to do. I did not want to represent talent in that way. And I was talking with one of the really successful commercial agents, and he said, I think you'd really like casting. And I said, yeah, I think I would, because I was talking to casting directors every day. And I think I had built up a pretty good reputation as being somebody, because I was a little bit older than some of the other assistants. I just had a communication style with casting directors that was pretty direct, that I think they appreciated. And my friend David at the time put out the word like, hey, Scott's looking for a casting gig. And I had a job offer that afternoon. So I went from being an agent's assistant to an assistant to a casting director or a casting assistant. And then I got promoted to associate. And then I was in charge of my own shows for a while. And then I was looking for other things to do. And I went back into talent management, which was an enormous mistake. It was just an enormous mistake. It was not fulfilling or anything. Although I worked with some really talented actors that are doing really well today. So I transitioned over into post-production, which was a really cool field. And I got to work on all the Lord of the Rings DVD content. Which was a complete, you know, nerdgasm for me as a kid who was such a geek growing up. So I got to work really closely with the B camera crew that was in New Zealand, filming all the interviews with the actors. And I would work with the editors, and then I kind of worked my way up to an associate producer, where I got to produce a couple of segments on a Disney DVD and some Warner classic movies. And it was great, but I had this really great gift that was given to me by one of my bosses. Cause I was trying to figure out like, okay, I need to figure out like, is this what I do for the rest of my life? And you know, we have a saying out here that entertainment is a harsh mistress, mm-hmm. because it is, when you're working, it's a freaking blast. I mean, it is just so much fun. It's the coolest people, but there is no guarantee. There is nothing solid. You know, you are basically going from job to job, and you know, you feel very transient. And I was at a point in my life where it's like, I got to figure this out. And I had been in therapy for a while, and my therapist said, I think you should consider going this direction. And I was like, nah, oh God, I'm sick of you listening to me. I can't believe you can listen to me. I don't want to do that. And he kind of convinced me and cajoled me for a while. And I went and took an intro class, and immediately my synapses started crackling in a way that they had not in a long time. And, you know, that was the beginning. I got halfway through a master's program and realized, like, no, I need the doctorate. And then I got halfway through the doctorate and I was like, I want to do the hardcore stuff. And, you know, I went right from that internship with Dr. Shiloh into working in the California Department of Corrections on a maximum security level 4 yard, you know, just sort of literally thrown into the most challenging environment. And it was great. So that's sort of my life story in a nutshell. I hope that's where you were heading with that question. I tend to kind of jump all over the place.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a minute I was going to ask a more frivolous question for a minute there and ask if you ever came across Lisa Zambetti when you were doing the casting or agent work. I don't know if you're familiar. She was a casting director for Criminal Minds for a long time, worked with Jim Clemente.
Oh, no. You know, we were different generations. I mean, like she's younger than me. And, you know, by the time was in, like, the, you know, there's a big turnover in casting. So, but I know of her and I think she does incredible work, like really incredible work.
Yeah. And then my internship. So that's a hell of a reboot story. breaking, you know, the rule of a gentleman asking your age. I don't know how old you are. You don't seem or look that old to have experienced as many years of life as you seem to have just described to me. How old were you when you decided, oh, you know what, I'm over this entertainment business and I'm going to go to school and get a doctorate in psychology and then start this whole new career?
I was 41. I was right at that age where, you know, like as an adult, hopefully you have an awareness at that point of like, okay, no, this is the real shit. I'm an adult. And, you know, there are things that need to be done to be prepared for the future. And, you know, I was raised by a really amazing woman who grew up, you know, in the Deep South during the Depression. And it was always about like, think about the future. I mean, you know, I think maybe there was a little bit too much fear. I wish there was a little bit more of emphasis on fulfillment. That wasn't necessarily emphasized, but in a roundabout way, I came back around and now I'm in a career that I can have as much passion about as when I was, you know, doing undergrad learning to be a performer. So yeah, I'm up there. We have some good genes in our family. So, you know, we tend to be a little bit more youthful. There's also some mood disorders and some other things that aren't so great, but you know, our skin is really good. So that's probably why I can pull it off.
Well, I feel terrible now because I've seen pictures of you online and I'm currently 41 and you definitely don't look older than me.
I'll send you my skin routine. I'll send you all the points of it.
Right. So this sounds like you work in psychology, you've worked in prisons, you work. I know you want to get into the organization, but in what capacity do you work with law enforcement?
So I say this without any exaggeration or grandiosity or inauthenticity. I have the best job in the world. I can't even believe that I lucked into this particular position that I didn't know existed. I'm part of what's called a co-responder model. So in most of the large urban areas of the U.S., starting a few years back, as there were more and more violent interactions with the mentally ill and police in the community that ended up tragically, you know, ended up in loss of life. Mm-hmm. Especially, well, it all started in Memphis, and in Memphis was having a number of these interactions, and they realized like, we've got to figure something out. So they brought in a sociologist and a social worker and a psychologist, and they did this big sort of, we need to regroup and figure this out. And they developed what was called the Memphis model of co-responders, which is instead of sending police out alone to these calls that end up being mental health calls, have a clinician go with you so that they can determine so that they can use their de-escalation skills in the same way that law enforcement uses their de-escalation skills, and therefore, and then move forward into an evaluation of what that particular individual's needs are. In Los Angeles, we have psychiatric emergency teams, we have psychiatric mobile response teams, we have, there's tons of acronyms that are basically a cop and a mental health clinician, and they roll out when someone is suicidal or barricaded in their home, or, you know, someone that's acting bizarrely or danger to themselves, danger to others, possibly gravely disabled. So those people might end up being hospitalized on a psychiatric hold. Out here, we call it a 5150 for a 72-hour hold for observation. And while I don't work, I've worked in that immediate and emergent psychiatric position. The position I have right now is I do the follow-up with a detective, and we go out in the community after someone has been hospitalized, and we have to determine, okay, is this person potentially a long-term threat to themselves, a long-term threat to their family, the community, et cetera? And what can we do to make sure that they are connected to services? And, you know, one of the things I can say about Southern California is the availability and understanding and emphasis on mental health care is by and large unlike any place else in the world. I mean, we have the most comprehensive mental health services in our cities and in our counties, as compared to anywhere else in the country and probably even the world. Not to say that there aren't some problems sometimes, but we really do a fantastic job of, you know, making sure that, like, this veteran who's suicidal but doesn't like to go to the VA and has a fear of the VA, what can we do to get him or her set up with services, and how can we encourage them to get in services? And I'm a real pit bull. Like, my partner is like this detective, and he's the good cop. I'm the one that's like pushing, you know, like educating families on, look, you know, your child is severely ill, and if they're not compliant with medications, then this is the sequelae. This is what's likely going to happen. And I'm really sorry to have this conversation with you, but you have to draw boundaries with your family members. And, you know, so a lot of it is psychoeducation and intervention and one-to-one therapy for a short time basis, transitional case management, de-escalation. We do hostage negotiation when it's called for. We do investigations to determine whether or not this individual that we are evaluating is on a path to extremism of any kind. And if so, what people in the community can we connect this individual with to divert those energies? So it's an enormous program with a lot of different responsibilities. It's incredibly fun. And it's the same every day, but also different every day, if that makes any sense.
Well, absolutely. Anytime you're dealing with people, then it's always different.
Right. And as from your former position, I know you understand what I'm talking about, because you were there on the scene doing a version of what we do.
100%. All right. So, Dr. Scott, today we're going to break down the case, the murder of Lacey and Connor Peterson. Lacey's husband, Scott Peterson, was convicted and sentenced to death in this case. Now, so just to kind of give the quick beats of it, and you could fill in anything that I'm missing here, but to get through the basics of the case really quickly. So it's Christmas Eve, 2002. Lacey Peterson is about 8.5 months pregnant with her son, who they'd already decided on the name Connor for. According to Scott, in his statements to police, he was around the house that morning till about 9:30. He leaves to go fishing, and around 10:30 in the morning, some neighbors see the Peterson's dog come wandering down the street with just the leash hanging off of him. And Scott gets home later that afternoon, and he realizes she's not there. Does some strange things, and what we're going to dig into is his psychology. So we'll come back to that. You know, takes a shower and stuff. Her car is there, her keys are there, her purse is there, but she's not there. He ends up calling her mom, and then her stepdad calls 911. The search begins, and there's a lot of strange things going on with Scott during the search for her. Ultimately, her body ends up being found mutilated, seemingly so, from being in the water in the ocean for that long, washes up in the San Francisco Bay, and ultimately Scott ends up being arrested and convicted. Now, the case is very it's contentious. It's one of those cases where there's a guilty camp and an innocent camp. Seems to me the innocent camp is the smaller camp in this group. But the reason it's still being talked about, two reasons right now. One, just a couple of months ago, the California Supreme Court overruled the death sentence for Scott Peterson based on the judge removing jurors from the jury pool based on the fact that they might be against the death penalty, which apparently they're not allowed to do. So that's been remanded back to a lower court. And as a matter of fact, the timing in this, Dr. Scott, was almost perfect because I don't know if you're aware of this, but we're recording this on November 5th. Tomorrow, Scott Peterson is due back in court on this very issue. Did you know that?
Yeah. I had, we had heard about it like sort of bits and pieces here and there about what was going to happen. And now it just seems like it's really moving quickly, which is, it just seems very odd that suddenly it's popped up at this time. I was wondering, I couldn't find out why now it's become such an issue to rehear this, but maybe that's been in the works with his defense for a while.
I think since about 2017, I mean, he's been, of course, anyone with a death sentence is constantly appealing, but I think the wheels started in motion for this in like 2017, worked through some lower courts, got up to the California Supreme Court. They unanimously ruled that the judge messed up and they sent it back down. And so now it's important to understand they didn't overturn his conviction. They overturned his sentence. So he's just going back to have the sentence reevaluated. And I don't know if it'll be another jury or how that's going to work tomorrow when he goes into court. But then it also seems, and I don't know how this is going to shake out, but there's a potential through another course of appeal that his conviction may be overturned based on a discovery that there was a juror that lied during, they're saying, the defense is saying she lied in order to get on the jury to convict Scott Peterson. And there was a question, have you ever been a victim of a crime? She said no. As it turns out, she was a victim of a crime, of an attack, when she herself was 4 months pregnant. So that may result in a whole new trial at some point.
And all I would say to that is, if that is true and if that is accurate, then that's the way our system is supposed to work. You know, the system failed everyone involved at the beginning if they did not do an appropriate screening of the jurors. And, you know, if that does is that going to change the mind of the majority of people and the preponderance of evidence in this case? I highly doubt it. But I think one of the things that people are reacting to is that they're immediately assuming that if he gets a retrial, then, you know, he's going to get released on a lack of evidence, which just doesn't, or it'll change his sentence, or he'll suddenly be released. And that just seems very unlikely to me.
Yeah, I can't see a jury not convicting him again.
Right.
And what we, you know, what we do with in Truth and Justice, you know, it's all about, you know, we work on wrongful conviction cases, but you know what we say all the time is we have to, if we want the system to work right and work fairly, then that means for all cases. So if this is one that,
yeah,
I mean, I'll tell you, I personally think he's guilty, but if he didn't receive a fair trial, then his conviction should be overturned and he should get another new trial. And that's basically the same problem that we have with the cases where we have innocent people who were convicted is, if the judges and prosecutors aren't doing their job properly, it results in mistakes. And sometimes the mistake is an innocent person goes to prison. And sometimes the mistake results in a guilty person getting out.
Right. And that's, unfortunately, we don't have a perfect system. We have one of the better ones in the world. But that is very much a chance. And it just shows, you know, with all due respect, I mean, and sincerely, I say this is like you're even being able to describe that in that way shows your ability to tolerate distress and use critical thinking skills, because people get very triggered about these kind of things. And I get triggered. I mean, I understand. I mean, I've worked in this milieu now for almost 2 decades, and I get that people want to make a bunch of assumptions and then they have their own anecdotal experience. And sometimes the juxtaposition of those two phenomenon result in just throwing critical thinking and rationality to the wind. And we can't afford that. We cannot afford that for anybody, no matter how disgusting the person is.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So in this case, so that's all some of the reasons my listeners want us to talk about it was to kind of get a better understanding what's going on with him legally right now. That's basically what's going on now. And for you listeners, the Friday follow-up this week, hopefully by then we'll have some more information on that to talk a little bit more about the case, about his legal case. But the case itself, the reason it's still being talked about is because it's not a super clear case of guilt, meaning there's no real direct evidence. There's not forensics other than, you know, a couple hairs found in a pair of pliers on the boat.
Yeah.
And but, you know, there's no eyewitnesses. There's no direct evidence. There's no physical evidence. So everything, the entire case was based on circumstantial evidence, which sounds weak, but in reality, in my opinion, the behavior of Scott Peterson, the behaviors of Scott Peterson, really, I mean, he either killed his wife and his unborn child, or he is the most unlucky human being on the planet for the set of circumstances that led him there, and also a pretty rotten person, I think, in my opinion. But do you want to walk through kind of what were his behaviors that led to his arrest and then conviction?
Well, let me frame it this way, with a preamble that Dr. Shiloh and I often use, and it's one of the things that we've done episodes on, and it can be incredibly frustrating, is, you know, the Nancy Graces of the world want to look at the most surface expression or affect of people like Peterson, who are in this position, and they want to then just really run with a bunch of assumptions. And, you know, in someone like her position, I'm using her. She's not the only one, but I'm using her as an example.
She's a great example.
Yeah, because she has a huge platform. And while I completely respect her intelligence, I have a real problem with, you know, how she chooses to use her platform to further, really, you know, further justice. And I don't think that's being done. And she's not the only one. Mm-hmm. So that being said, it's about, we need to be really careful about judging. One of the most frustrating examples is when they talk about, you know, whether whoever it is sitting behind that defendant's chair, sitting in the defendant's chair, wow, she's not showing any emotion. She's just stone cold. He is just blank. He is this, he is that. And the problem with that is that you're dipping into brief moments of what is ostensibly a very long and involved and emotionally exhausting process. And you're making quick snap judgments on these brief moments in time that may or may not, and generally don't actually reflect accurately on what is objectively happening in that moment or objectively representing that individual. And it's frustrating that this has gone on in our judicial system for years. And, you know, we're even, I've been in a courtroom where judges have just, you know, gone off on defendants for, you know, your lack of showing any remorse. You're sitting here day after day. But then on the other hand, if someone is just a fraction too much performative and has too much of an expressive affect, the same thing happens on them and people start crying crocodile tears and all sorts of judgments. So I want to be very careful or very clear with people that I'm want to be careful about that. But all that being said, in this particular case, what I want to do, or what I do when I'm looking at this particular case or this particular example, is I think of it in terms of measurements of, and I'm going to use a bizarre term and I've kind of made it up, but I'm thinking of like sort of a multidimensional hologram rather than a spectrum of behaviors. And so we're talking about how much, in what way, under what circumstances, and in what environment are we talking about? So if you just had a run-of-the-mill individual who was accused of murder and was acting in this way, and the trial had gone on for 6 months, you know, I think we need to be really careful about the things we said. But in response to, you know, where we're going now, looking at what his behaviors were leading up to all of this, that gives a clear picture to me. And I'm going to say, just this is my professional opinion, that he really presents with a lot of guilt. You know, there's a lot of evidence that show a chronic pattern of behaviors that indicate psychopathy. And there's also a historical background of his previous behaviors and his family upbringing that really seem significant to me. That's the way I would say it. So I don't know if you're familiar. There's also a psychiatrist, Dr. Keith Ablow, who has written a bunch of books. He's like a big media psychiatrist. He got in a lot of trouble recently because he apparently couldn't keep it in his pants. And I used to have a lot of respect for him as a forensic psychiatrist. And he wrote a book, Inside the Mind of Scott Peterson. And I was really disappointed in reading it, because he, for someone who works in my field, he made enormous leaps about who Peterson is as a person, and made enormous leaps in connections and made assumptions diagnostically that he really should not have done. Because in our position, you know, I am a psychologist, so I'm not necessarily working under the ruling that psychiatrists are supposed to follow, which is to not diagnose. But we do encourage ourselves when we're looking at something forensically. So we're looking at all the data in front of us that's historic, that's chronic, that's current. We look at it and we want to be dispassionate, and we want to be looking primarily at behaviors and not necessarily throwing a diagnosis at the person. So that's my long-winded way of saying that if we look at Scott, some of the things that really stick out for me, and, you know, believe me, I pick out things or things are significant to me that other psychologists would not find indicative of anything. And they might see something that I don't see. So that's why it's really great to collaborate. And it's one of the reasons Dr. Shiloh is so great to work with, because we really see things. We kind of have different lenses on things, and it comes together really well. But one of the biggest things for me in looking at the behaviors leading up to this is, if we go back to the courting of Lacey by Scott, the extent that he went to create this sort of rom-com fantasy meal. So she shows up and he's got like a dozen red roses, and then they go on a deep sea fishing excursion where she's sick the whole time. You know, she has seasickness, and there's just like this overt romanticism without really knowing the person at all. And also not asking, like, what are you into? It to me is one of those behaviors that really falls in that personality disordered thing of, I need to make such a huge impression on this person, so this is what I'm going to do. And then later, and the only reason that that is particularly significant to me is because he repeats the same thing with Amber when he takes her out. And there's, again, another bunch of roses. And I'm so sorry, I'm blanking on it, because it's either Lacey's mom or Amber's mom. He buys another dozen roses, only they're in white to sort of honor the mom. And, you know, just this over-the-top rom-com version that to me indicates when somebody has a really split self. And I'm not saying that he has a dual personality. I'm not saying that he's anything like that. I'm saying that he has what we would call a false persona or a mask persona. There's a mask that he wears that has worked very well for him throughout his life to get people to react to him in a certain way.
And isn't that similar to what we see in, you know, one of the most notorious serial killers, Ted Bundy, had that same type of thing, right? Or am I off on that?
No, you're absolutely right. It's what we would call superficial charm. So it's about going through the motions. I mean, the real empathy and the real connection, rather than doing like huge grand gestures, is to have time to spend with somebody intimately and like get to know what they like and what they're into. There's another thing that is certainly a big giveaway is, if you go into the information that was revealed eventually about how he met Amber, is that he was in a hotel cocktail bar and hit on a girl by using, I mean, his pickup line was asking her what her favorite sexual position was. And she was, I guess she wasn't put off too much, but she wasn't interested. So she said, "Hey, I think you might know somebody that I like," which is a whole other bizarre story. Like some idiot comes up to you with a crude come on line and you go, "Oh, that kind of grosses me out, but hey, my friend might like it," you know, which is bizarre. But it also, once again, illustrates that split between who he actually is versus what he wants to present to the public on a regular basis as the family guy, as the, you know, everybody talks about him having this megawatt smile and how he could light up a room. Well, you know, even animals learn to respond to their environment with behaviors and expressions that get them the most attention. So in this way, I think that he really represents, you know, an individual that has learned to mimic charm, and he's learned to mimic a lot of things that are impressive to people.
Right. I do want to jump in real quick and just occurred to me that for anybody that's listening to this that isn't familiar with the case, that Amber Fry is the woman that Scott was having an affair with at the time of Lacey and Connor's murder. I just wanted to make sure I put that out there so people aren't getting confused.
Yes, thank you for that. Sorry about for jumping into that too much. You know, I'm jumping around here, but another huge example, and I mean, Scott's backstory is quite fascinating. The family backstory is so profound, and there's so much to look at in doing sort of a psych profile, which I'm not doing because I don't have all the data. But I'm reflecting on what I do have available to me is very interesting because there is a lot of trauma in his family background. And his parents are odd, to say the least. Their response to a lot of this was very, very odd. And now, once again, I want to certainly give them the leeway of saying that this was an absolutely extraordinary situation that no one would know how to necessarily navigate, right? If you know, your son is accused of these horrible things. But as a background, a woman, he has a, he had a half sister who they were, you know, this woman, Ann Bird, only became reattached to her mom, who is Scott Peterson's mom, as an adult when she found out she had been adopted, because Scott's mom had been through some really difficult times and had to give her child up for adoption. So at the beginning, when she was able to reconnect with the family, one of the things that Ms. Bird says about meeting her biological mom is like, although it was like a really great experience to like, oh, to reconnect with her biological origins, there wasn't really a lot of interest shown in, you know, who she was as a person. There were sort of like a lot of superficial questions that were being asked by mom. Now, I'm just saying that as an aside because I'm going to place it over. So that's just something that jumped out at me when I was reading the material. But then later, when everything goes down and he's trying to get away from the media, which is always, you know, surrounding his home, he goes and he lives with his half sister, this recently found half sister. And she remarked that during his stay with them, he was the most empty person that she had ever encountered. And to quote her from one of her interviews is, "Everything he does seems to have been copied from someone else." And to me, that when we're looking at sort of leaning towards a diagnosis of psychopathy, that is a huge tell. It's like a poker tell. Just this emptiness about him.
And the copying, where does that come from? Because, you know, I've heard that other people, you know, that have been kind of diagnosed, at least on the internet, as right, as psychopaths, you hear that where it's like they almost don't know how to have things like empathy or to be able to have relationships. And so they literally just mimic other people's behaviors.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's a whole other rabbit hole to go down that Dr. Shiloh is. She explains it so much more elegantly than I do, but there's certainly, we've found in multiple MRIs that there's a difference in the brain structure and that there's also the presence of what is called the warrior gene in a lot of psychopaths. But that's also to remember that, you know, out of the percentage of our world population of people that fall within the sociopathy and psychopathy parameters, not all of them are going to end up being criminals, or not all of them are going to end up being horrific serial killer criminals, such as the big examples that we see. What we do know is that it is a combination of nature and nurture. So if you have a kid that has these tendencies, but they're in a really great structured environment, then they may not really feel compassion and empathy and sympathy the way you or I would, because we have those regular brain structures, but they can learn very quickly, like, oh, this is the way you're supposed to go through life. And if I do this, then I am rewarded in this way. And they can have a type of experience that is certainly not the emotional spectrum that someone who's neuronormative would have, but they can have a kind of it and they can learn from it. So what's a good example? What is it? There's a great saying when we talk about people with sociopathy is they use a music metaphor. They know the words, but they can't hum the tune.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. I think the thing that makes it difficult sometimes, because when you look at, especially there's just so much available to the public that is interested in this genre of true crime. And I think it's great that people, you know, the more people learn about human behavior, I think the better, even if it's in these sort of, you know, media / entertainment outlets. But when we look at somebody like, that's a big personality, like, oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. We were just talking about him.
Ted Bundy?
Ted Bundy. So sorry. How could I possibly forget Ted Bundy? Because he's everywhere. But Ted Bundy, you know, had sort of what we would call the positive symptoms of psychopathy, in that he had this underlying narcissism and a need to be recognized for achievement in these ways, and a real need to have this positive regard reflected back to him in ways that the rest of us just sort of like, oh, well, they don't really think much of me. That's okay. I go on with my day. So for someone like Ted Bundy, he really, really needed that reflection back, and he needed it in an overt way. And my theory about Scott Peterson is that he had more covert personality symptoms, like covert narcissism, covert psychopathy that ran below the surface. And that's how he acted out. Is that he was able to hold it together for this veneer for family and community, but then he would act out by having these affairs where he could actually create like a completely different persona for them. You know, he goes in and meets Amber, and she's a single mom with a kid, and he's sweeping her off her feet and, you know, telling her he's in Paris. You know, he's just creating this big story. To me, that's, you know, does that mean that he killed Lacey? That in itself absolutely does not. But his ease in lying throughout all of this is really both astounding and impressive. So, you know, he's just able to generate this alternate reality for someone that he feels is so compartmentalized that she's not going to find out what's going on.
Well, that was a big part of, I think, why he was avoiding the media, because he was maintaining this relationship with Amber at first, telling her that he wasn't married. And then he, if I understand it right, he eventually, you know, quote, comes clean and tells her, well, he was married, but he lost his wife. And this was going to be the first Christmas without his wife. And he tells her this 2 weeks or so before his wife goes missing.
Which is clearly emotional manipulation, you know, creating this persona of me. Not only am I a really great guy, but look at the pain that I've been through, and I'm still going to soldier through, and I'm going to offer you the chance at happiness in your life. You know, it's really is sort of just trying to create this Hallmark rom-com type of scenario. And he just slides in and out of that reality so easily. I mean, I guess I'd use the word chilling. To me, one of the most chilling things is, in the middle of the investigations and everything going on, he is simultaneously having these conversations with Amber and lying to her about where he is and what's going on. At one point, he was even telling her that he was in Paris for New Year's.
Right. And that was while, wasn't that while he was at a candlelight vigil?
Yes.
For Lacey. I can't even understand. Maybe you can help explain it, or if it maybe it's not explainable. But when I saw that, it's like, what? Why right then? Why in the middle of this vigil does he step out and call his mistress and make up the story about how he's in Paris?
I think two things are going on. One is that despite the likelihood of him having a different brain structure and a different chemical or a different, you know, genetic makeup than the general public, there is a level of self-soothing and overstimulation that happens in anybody, regardless of levels of psychopathy in them. And at that moment, he was overwhelmed. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're going to get your fix in whatever way you can. And the way you can get it in that moment is to go back into the fantasy. I mean, to draw a parallel, I'm not sure if this was off before we started recording or not, but you and I were talking about my World of Warcraft recovery. And one of the things that I realized that I was doing when I was gaming, and I really loved that game, but it was during an incredibly stressful period of my life while I was working full time and going to graduate school full time. You know, the last thing I needed to be doing was playing for 4 hours until 2 a.m, even though I thought it was going to relax me and make me feel better because I could completely dissociate and go into this game. And, you know, it just, after a while, the law of diminishing returns, it just didn't work for me anymore because I'm relatively neuronormal as opposed to someone like Scott, that in this moment of after allegedly, well, I mean, he's been adjudicated for it. So after committing this crime, this is his fix, is everybody's looking at me. I'm on the spot. I'm not sure how much support I'm getting from my family and community. They always, you know, they're always going to look at the husband or the boyfriend. So I'm going to move over to my fantasy world and get some external validation.
That makes sense. That actually makes a lot of sense, because that was so baffling to me. It's like, why wouldn't you just wait till it's over? Like, right. What a horrible time to make that call. And of course, he didn't realize that the police were on the other end recording it.
Right. Right. But I think, Bob, you're hitting on something also that is so important. And I say this, like, I give this example when I, because I have a private practice as well as my regular work. And, you know, I'll work with individuals coming out of relationships. And, you know, I always have such a very tender place for people who are coming out of relationships with other individuals who have personality disorders, whether it be narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder, or they're coming out of abusive relationships. And I'll tell you, the main thing they want to know, whether they're male, female, anything, why did this happen? Why did he treat me this way? Why did she do this to me? I just want to know why. And I have to tell them every time, you're not going to know why. And if I could tell you why, and I can tell you why, because he's got a person or she's got a personality disorder, the answer is not going to be good enough, because you're looking at it through this lens of, if I can figure out why this individual acts in this way, then I can adjust my actions and my emotions accordingly to not feel so bad about it. When the actual metaphor should be, look, you don't live in crazy town. You live over here in relatively normal town. And the minute you drive out of your neighborhood over there to crazy town, you're going to be lost. Mm-hmm. You know, this is about tolerating distress. And I mean, from a, you know, mourning what you can't have, but to circle back around to your point of, like, people just want to understand why this happens. And it's just because we want to understand what basically are almost primal animal urges from the actions of psychopaths.
Well, that's fascinating to me, that, and it makes a lot of sense, the reason why, you know, on a much more innocuous level, you know, I struggle sometimes. I have 4 kids and 2 of them have ADHD. My youngest right now is in school. And I have to, and we go to a counselor and or therapist and help him work through some things. But I'm constantly talking to the counselor after our sessions, like telling him things just like this. I don't understand why he's doing that.
Yeah.
You know, things like, you know, why is he doing something that he knows is going to get him in trouble? And he's constantly explaining back to me that, you know, you can't understand it. Your brain doesn't work the same way his brain works. Like, this makes, there's a reason for this. It makes sense to him. You know, and that's very, you know, anecdotal, a little innocuous thing. But, you know, when I expand that out to where somebody's literally their brain is wired different, that's just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, every couple of weeks, I'm part of a training program for law enforcement in California. And I do these lectures kind of introducing the basic concepts of mental health diagnosis. And one of the things that I try and I give it as an example is, and I, you know, I'm happy to share this, is that, you know, I'm the youngest of five children. And I grew up in a time in the South in the 60s where there was not a vocabulary for many mental health issues. And I came from a culture, and there's a lot of great things about Southern culture. I mean, I just adore it, and I'm glad I'm from the South. But there's this culture of, you don't talk about certain things. And, you know, there was a time in my life where the word cancer was whispered, because it was implied that people got cancer because they did something wrong or they didn't take care of themselves. And then the same thing started happening with mental illness. And of course, another thing that we also do in our culture is that because the mother is the primary nurturer, we tend to really fall towards blaming mothers for everything, which is incredibly unfair. And my experience was having a rapid cycling bipolar father who was the most charming, intelligent. I mean, he was just an amazingly gifted man until he wasn't. And when he was in the irritable or the depressive phase of his mental illness, it was really bad for our family. But we didn't have a context to understand it. And I remember years later in therapy, you know, trying to work through some of the anger as a young man, trying to like find my own identity as a man, as juxtaposed to what I didn't get from my dad, and just all this anger. My therapist said something so incredibly profound. He said, you know, Scott, if your dad acted that way because he had a huge tumor inside his skull and it was pressing on these certain nerves, and that's the reason he did this, would it make a difference to you? And I immediately said, yeah, absolutely. It's not his fault. And of course, my therapist's response was, that's what we're talking about, is that it is. Except that it's not a tumor. It's a collection of chemicals and it's a brain structure. And that's why he acts this way. Yes, there is some, he does have some agency in his decisions and volition in his decisions, but he has been dealing with this illness his entire life. His whole life has molded around managing this. And, you know, you guys have to experience the fallout. So sorry to derail a little bit there, but I think it's important for all of us that love this genre to just hold everything with an open mind and remember that when we're doing profiles and when we're, you know, sort of supposing about what people's motives were, you always really need to hold this open space for what you don't know. And when you don't leave that open space, you end up being Nancy Grace or Keith Ablow.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Coming back to the Peterson case before we run out of time, some of the basic things that he did that I'm really interested in. So he was having this affair. I already mentioned that he tells Amber, which is another victim of this, by the way, I think. I mean, that
absolutely
had no idea that any of this was happening. He tells her 2 weeks before the murders that he had lost his wife. Then she goes missing. He says he's, you know, he took his boat out that day, which, you know, this is something I have some expertise in. He has a little 14-foot boat. I have a little 14-foot boat just like his sitting out in my barn, and I won't even take it here on Lake Michigan, but he's testing it out in the San Francisco Bay in the ocean, which, you know, I find suspect to begin with.
I completely agree. And I wish there was more emphasis put on that. To me, it seems like that's almost tossed off. I mean, the fact that he lied saying he was playing golf and then he told somebody else he was out in his boat, and the idea of like, wait, you bought a boat and you're going to drive a 90-minute round trip journey to this place on Christmas Eve. And I know there's a lot of controversy about that, of like, no, this is what some people do. And I absolutely disagree. I think that, like, especially if you're invested in the veneer of the nuclear American family, that's not what the male unit does. That's you know, it just doesn't fit. And what's interesting is that there are a lot of there. Well, not a lot. I will say there are some significant females out in the community who are quite enamored with Scott, and they write these defensive articles that actually are quite well written, but they try and pull that apart. And I don't buy it at all. I think that's incredibly another tell that he was gone, you know, that he was saying that that was a normal thing, that he was going to be gone at that time. And also, by the way, related to that, returning to the scene of the crime, huge tell, you know, the number of times that he went back to watch them is just you. That is such an incredible tell of someone who has committed a crime.
Right. You know, so he's going out there doing something insane. Like, even if he was an asshole that's going to go out golfing or fishing on Christmas Eve while his wife's getting ready for the dinner. Like I said, even just the logistics of that boat's not made for the ocean. So right. Why the hell would you go that far
right.
to go in the ocean? But then, so then she disappears. He does some, I mentioned earlier, does some strange things. He gets home and says that he gets home. Now his wife's gone. His dog's in the backyard with a leash on it. Her keys are there. Her purse is there. Her car is there. And he takes a shower. You know, it's like no alarm bells were raised at that point. And I know, like, if I come home and my wife's car's here and my wife's not here, I'm immediately going to be raising some alarms. Like, where the hell is she?
Right. And this is where it gets a little bit wonky, going back to that point of like, we have to be really careful about what we consider to be what should be objectively normal. And it might not be normal for them. You know, I mean, but I agree with you. We just have to be careful with it. And I think that an important overlay here, which actually is quite a parallel to Chris Watts there and Scott Peterson, there's a very interesting parallel between their home lives that you look, they lived in these houses that were immaculate, which really takes a lot of work. You know, there's just like this real emphasis in both of these families on the external veneer and how you're perceived. And both of these women, these young women and moms, were really known to be energetic and loved by the community and involved in a bunch of things with these good looking but slightly odd guys. You know, I just find that really interesting because, like you're saying, I want to be careful, or like I was saying, I want to be careful. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. His behaviors of jumping in the shower when you can't find who they are, nobody's answering your call, and all the belongings are there. Alarm bells should have been going off like sirens at that point.
Yeah, I would think so. But so then he eventually, as I said, it was the stepdad that ends up calling the police, and then he doesn't do himself any favors with the media, which we later find out is because of his relationship with Amber Fry. But you know, they're giving press conferences, they're pleading for, you know, if somebody has Lacey to bring her back, and he's gone. He won't be in front of the cameras at all. And now my assumption from that is he had this whole fantasy world going on with Amber Fry, and he didn't want her to see him on the news and find out that he was married and his wife was missing.
Right. Therefore, like the hats and the sunglasses and always being on the phone with his chin down whenever he was in front of cameras. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then they have a ton of recorded phone calls throughout the time when Lacey's missing still, where he's carrying on with Amber. And, you know, you talked about the grandiose, the roses, the rom-com date, and even one of the documentaries I watched, they played some of the tapes, and listening to him talk to her was exactly that. He was like, I always tell you, you're so special, but there's not a word. There needs to be a better word because you're more than special, and just over the top. Same type of thing, and this all being done while Lacey's still missing. And then I thought it was, I'm curious your take on it. I thought it was kind of a big tell that before Lacey and Connor's bodies were found, he had put their house up for sale. I think he'd sold a vehicle and he put their house up for sale. Like, when I read that, I thought, if his wife's just missing, he doesn't know what happened to her and she might be coming back, And I guess I'm probably doing the same thing, putting my own, you know, what would I do, which we got to be careful not to do. But
right. And there are factors. I mean, like if you dive into it, he talks about how the police had possession of one car. Lacey's didn't run that well. I mean, like, you know, there was actually sort of an objective rationale for why he did it. But this is a great example of operating from a different emotional paradigm, because you, if you were in that position, would go, that would not be appropriate for me to do right now. It would not be appropriate for me at this stage in the game to sell this car, to sell this house, to just start compartmentalizing and making for another life. That's an aberrant behavior. So, you know, even if it's like, wow, my money is really short and I need this and this and this, that still would not be the time to do it. And the lack of understanding of that, while it doesn't necessarily indicate guilt, it does show that this guy is operating mentally and emotionally on a different level.
Yeah. I mean, the fact I can't imagine. And again, it's based on what's going on in my brain, but even having, if my wife was missing, even being able to think about something like selling my house.
Right.
While that's going on. And, you know, and the, you know, where my brain went was that he knows she's dead. No, he's the only one that knows that she's dead and she's not coming back. So
right.
He's ready to move on.
You know, several years ago, a relative of mine went missing for a while. And I remember my sister calling me on the phone very early one morning, and she was in tears, not knowing what had happened, and was trying to figure things out on her end on the other side of the country. I was a wreck all day. Like, I was just an absolute wreck. And I was a wreck for 3 days until it was somewhat resolved. And even then we were unsure. So once again, I mean, I want to be careful about sort of making broad comparisons, but you know, it is quite a tell that he reacted in that particular way. And then, I mean, I think out of all this, the biggest getaway biggest tell is his attempt to escape.
Right.
You know, like the hair color, like, you know, there was planning that went into this. And that was, to me, was just a huge tell of his guilt, that he wasn't, you know, most profilers will tell you this, and really good interviewers will tell you that, like, you know, when somebody's innocent, they won't stop talking. They just keep talking and keep talking because they know they're innocent. You know, I mean, that's a generalization, but here's someone that like suddenly just up and takes off.
Hey, colors his hair. He had what, like $15,000 cash?
Several changes of clothing. You know, like all, there were some things that were indicating that he had his brother's ID and a couple of other things in the car that were telling too, not necessarily like indicating criminality, but once again, sort of like work clothes and full on dress clothes that he was planning on sort of finding a new identity across the border.
Right. Okay. So now to kind of wrap this up, and I know that we could go on with this case for hours and hours and hours.
Absolutely.
But to kind of wrap this up, so we've talked about some of his behaviors, and that some of the behaviors could be explained by psychopathy, sociopathy. There's reasons his brain's wired different is the reason he's doing some of these things. But knowing that, knowing the behaviors that he actually went through pre-offense and post-offense, and knowing, or your assessment of what his mental state is, do you think that he killed his wife?
I do. You know, we have a forensic psychologist that really sort of wrote the book on so much of this data. And he is a professor here in Southern California, Dr. Reed Malloy. And the guy is just, he's like sort of Saint Malloy to all of us. And his reflections on this particular situation, you know, when we talk about motivation, I think he kind of nails it on the head, is that this is an individual who just didn't, you know, he never wanted to be a father, never wanted to be a family man, but he wanted that veneer of it. And then when he had to come up, crush against the reality of I'm going to be a father, he just decided, no, I'm going to change all that. And I can figure out a plan and a way to do it. And, you know, Reed Malloy, there's a great quote he has, is the absence of true foundational structural empathy gives the psychopath the ability at times to kill without remorse and to kill with reasons filled with banality. others' emotions of grief and rage and fury are like water off a duck's back. So I think that that's the place that he got to, is that I just don't want to be in this reality anymore. And the easiest way out is to remove the person that I see as the problem of it.
Well, this conversation has been fascinating, Dr. Scott, and I want to have you back on again sometime. I think we've got someone else I want to have help weigh in. We always have Jim Clemente come on anytime we're looking for a psychological analysis of some criminal behaviors, but he's got a busy schedule. So hopefully next time we have someone like that, you might be available to come help chime in with us.
Oh, we'd love to. I mean, that'd be great. And Dr. Shiloh and I would love to be on anytime you want our, you know, God knows we can both talk nonstop. So anytime.
And the podcast is great. It's called LA Not So Confidential. If you want to, before I let you go, if you highlight maybe a couple episodes or a couple cases that you guys have covered that my audience might be interested in.
Yeah, we cover the range of forensic psychology and the crimes associated with them, and then also how it's portrayed in the media. And our Scott Peterson episode is one of the highest rate. I think we had like our just tens of thousands of downloads on it. And we have two. One is Never Marry a Peterson, because we talk about Drew Peterson and Scott Peterson. And then we also have one called Dual Lives or Double Lives. So those are really great. And we're getting tons of feedback on our latest episode, which is about sexsomnia, which is a parasomnia where a person goes into a fugue state while sleeping and can act in very aberrant ways, and how that has been used as a criminal defense in cases. So we touch on a little bit of everything. We also have a live broadcast the Saturday after we drop. We're on Get Vocal, where we have our fans and listeners jump in to ask questions, and we, you know, sort of riff on topics. So please join us. We'd love to have any other listeners that are interested in our show.
That'd be awesome. And I actually just myself listened today to your episode on the sexopathy. Am I saying that right?
Sexsomnia.
I listened to that one today, and also fascinating. They're all great. I hope you guys give them a listen. And Dr. Scott, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And I personally can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth, and Mike can be found @MurbGaming, MurbGaming. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases.
That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
Say goodbye to the dish and hello to Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky over Wi-Fi. So you can get unmissable Sky shows like The Last of Us and Succession, as well as Netflix and Discovery Plus, and loads more, all in one subscription for £26 a month. Oh, and next day delivery with no upfront fee. Sky Stream, TV simplified. Head to sky.com. Requires Sky Stream and broadband minimum speed 10 megabits per second, 18-month minimum term. Cut-off times apply for next day delivery. Excludes bank holiday. 18 plus. Terms apply.